Here is Alan Minsky.
Our theme music, Stand Up, Rise Up, was written and performed by Kemp Harris. Our proofreader is Elizabeth Solomon. Our associate producer is Hannah Feldman. Our social media manager is Stephen Wendt.
Join us next week on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you, everybody. When you read The Day the Rats Vetoed Congress, my fable, but a lot of realism, you'll want to join the Congress Club.
Listen to me, people. Do you understand? We got to stand up. Oh, you've been sitting way too long.
Oh, stand up.
You know what's right and you know what's wrong.
Rise up.
Don't let the system pull you down.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. The Ralph Nader Hour with Ralph Nader came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up is Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund at 7 o'clock. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Julian Gioiello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you join it as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
I believe that we have got to mobilize a larger movement to reclaim the democracy.
Radio broadcaster Bob Law.
Some of y'all have underestimated the value and the appeal of white supremacy. And you have no idea how strong white privilege and white supremacy is.
Tune in to From the Streets with Bob Law, which gives voice to a wide range of black and progressive political and cultural perspectives. That's 11 to noon Saturdays here over listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. On this morning's program, an interview with best-selling writer Veronica Roth. But first, a review by Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. You listen to or read enough horror movie reviews, you notice that critics are pretty negative about shock cuts or scare cuts. or whatever you want to call them, you know, the thing where the film lingers on the close-up of a character and then suddenly the monster lunges into frame, usually to some kind of shock sting on the soundtrack, like, and I guess some may feel that that's an elitist thing to be critical of that. The trope is low-hanging fruit, but it works, so what's the problem? Well, Hitchcock had an answer for that, which for reasons of time we can't get into, but the newish French horror film Candisha, which is now streaming on the Shudder on-demand service, provides another. In the film, Amelie, played by Mathilde Lamousse, has been the victim of a failed rape by her ex-boyfriend and summons Candisha, a Moroccan demon of vengeance, to take care of him, which the female spirit does, fatally, and then goes on to murdering a number of other men in the lives of Amelie and her two friends, because it turns out, once you've squeezed the toothpaste of revenge out of the tube, it's hard to get it back in again. A good ways into the film, and I'm going to try to keep the details spoiler-free here, the trio meets up with whom they believe to be the next victim and follow him into his house, ready to warn him. And directors Alexander Bastillo and Julian Mori abruptly cut to the women beholding the victim already in Candisha's clutches. I understand it, we're supposed to be caught off guard, but something in the timing, plus the fact that Candisha, who presents as a goat-legged woman, has grown significantly in stature by this point, makes the moment not shocking, but just funny. I giggled, and while that can be appropriate for a horror film, this wasn't the right place. But let me say this about that. This is not a fatal error, just a glitch in an otherwise interesting Gallic take on a Blumhouse-style teen horror film. Directors Bastillo and Mori set their tale in a lower-class neighborhood of Muslim immigrants, which allows them such novel wrinkles as the way the friends rag on each other with race-based teasing and having an exorcism sequence presided over by an excommunicated imam. More, by making their monster the mythical figure of a murdered woman called upon by women similarly abused, they give their story some serious teeth and a theme that, unfortunately, is still too relevant. Add to that the increasingly brutal nature of the murders. Bastillo and Mori know you don't have to unleash all the gore from the first frame, and Candisha is a horror film that takes a familiar template and gives it a distinctive character all its own. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. In April last year, right about the beginning of the pandemic lockdown, I conducted an interview with Veronica Roth, who's doubtless best known for her Divergent trilogy of books and the related short stories aimed at a young adult audience. The series was made into what was supposed to be a trilogy of films, then a TV series, and things got bollocksed up with studio issues. But last year saw the release of her first novel truly focused for an adult audience entitled Chosen Ones, which was recently released in softcover, making it ripe for a rebroadcast. Also, the forthcoming release of the third filmed version of Dune, perhaps the ultimate Chosen One science fiction story, makes this timely. So, as I am wont to say, set your Wayback Machine to April 2020 for a phone interview with Veronica Roth. I think we should slate this. This is April 6th at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in New York and an hour earlier where my guest is. My guest is Veronica Roth, who is one of the major players in brilliant science fiction, especially some of it noted for young people. But her latest book, her book technically being released tomorrow, April 7th, is Chosen Ones. And this is the first book that you've written targeting adults.
That's right. Yeah. Kind of a debut, another debut for me.
Yeah, which is great. And the book isn't out and you've sold the movie rights.
Well, yes. That part was also exciting.
Yeah, it's. I mean, that's when you've achieved that kind of recognition. Well, you know, what can one say? That's that's as good as it gets. Okay, let's see. I was looking at your bio a little while ago, and I found it absolutely fascinating. We have a few things in common. Number one, you're originally from New York.
I am, yeah. I was born in Mount Kisco, New York.
Okay. I'm looking at the bio on your website, which is not as extensive, of course, as Wikipedia. But in Wikipedia, now, this I read like a month ago, you have an interesting family background.
Do I?
Yeah, I thought.
I wonder what the Wikipedia says. I haven't ever actually looked at it.
Let's see. Yes. Raised primarily in Barrington, Illinois. Okay. I've actually passed through there. German and Polish descent. Well, with the name Freund, you can guess I'm German.
Yeah.
Or at least my parents were. They were both Holocaust survivors.
Where were they from in Germany?
My father from Nuremberg and my mother from Frankfurt am Main.
Oh, so when I was a kid, we lived near-ish Frankfurt.
Oh, really?
For a little while. I think, yeah. Well, I don't know how near we were. I don't remember a lot about it, so I'm not great about the facts. But my father is from Cologne.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But a generation later.
No. Well, yeah, I'm first-generation American.
Okay, so both of us. So just that family background and the knowledge of coming out of Holocaust-surviving families, is it fair to say that's a factor in your writing?
Well, you know, my relationship to the family history is a little bit weird because I just have never been sure of any of it. I remember a few years ago when I went to Europe for the Divergent movie press stuff, them asking me about my grandfather being a Holocaust survivor, and I was like, well, he's not. But then, because I was afraid of claiming something that I didn't know the facts of. But then when my grandfather passed away at the ripe old age of 104,
whoa,
which is amazing, this was a couple of years ago, my cousin verified, you know, which camp he was in, and all that. So it turns out I was just being overly cautious, but yeah, I don't know how it influences me. I feel like it must in ways that I'm not aware of exactly. My mother's done some research into, you know, intergenerational like memory and stuff like that. That has been really interesting. And certainly my grandfather was a strange figure when I was growing up, always so much older than me. Like the gap between us was significant. So anyway, the memory of him is an influence, but it's hard to connect the dots for writers, you know, in terms of what is influencing you and what isn't.
What was your upbringing like?
Man, what was it like? My parents got divorced when I was 5. So it was just my mom, really. My dad was a figure in the background. And, man, what else to say about it? It was a good upbringing, a good childhood.
I'm guessing that you were a reader.
So I read like in the shower, you know, I'd hold books out of the spray. So like half my childhood books were like rippled
mm-hmm.
from getting wet. My sister played sports and volleyball specifically. And so I kind of got dragged to every game. And I'd sit under the bleachers with books. So it was just like the only way that I really enjoyed passing my time.
So of course the next question has to be what books? What books were your favorites?
I really loved Animorphs.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with that series, but it's
an
epically long series about alien invasion. And God, I love those books. They're so dark. I refreshed my memory about some of the plot lines in those books recently, and I was like, damn, these are rough for, you know, readers aged 9 and up. Like, that's pretty intense. I love that. But anyway, so there were Animorphs, and then I also read like Judy Blume and The Babysitter's Club and just more standard, like contemporary stuff. But then A Wrinkle in Time and The Giver were huge for me. Read them over and over again. And then Harry Potter, when I got a little older, mm-hmm. it came out when I was 11. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm afraid to say how old I was probably, about 45 or so when Harry Potter first came out.
Oh, boy.
So,
well, here we are.
But yeah. On the other hand, I was riveted to them.
And they're very special. I mean, I know what the flaws in them are. I feel well acquainted with them, but those books, I mean, I can read them over and over and over again, and I find new things, which is just wonderful.
Yeah, there are few series of books that I can read for just utter escape. And right now, as we are living, certainly we're living in a dystopia. Even
yeah, nothing will acquaint you with that quite like going to the grocery store right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's escape books are really needed.
I agree.
When you started, now we don't want to talk that much about Divergent, but it's the elephant in the room. When you started writing that, and it's certainly definitively dystopic, what propelled that? This is a fancy way of saying, where do you writers get those crazy ideas?
Oh my God. Well, it's funny because, I mean, I think, I'm sure you know about the timing of publishing, but a lot of just the average reader doesn't really. So the dystopian kind of craze hadn't happened when I wrote Divergent. And then it happened, it started to happen with The Hunger Games, and then it caught me in its wave. So I was and will always be grateful to The Hunger Games for that. But so when I wrote it, it wasn't like this very intentional, I'm going to write a dystopia kind of feeling. But what I had been in a psychology course in my freshman year of college, and I was learning about exposure therapy, which is a method of treating anxiety and phobias in which you, in a safe environment, repeatedly encounter whatever stimulus provokes your anxiety or fear. And over time, you become desensitized to whatever that thing is. And you can have a lot of success in combating anxiety and phobias in this way. So I found that really interesting because it sounds like a nightmare, you know? Like that's torture, basically, and it helps you, which is strange. And I thought about using it in a science fiction kind of way because I love to science fictionize whatever I can. And I built a society around that. So like what kind of people would want to eradicate fear and why? And that's where the world building Divergent came about, basically.
How did the transfer to movie strike you?
It was quite a time, let me tell you. So I am but a simple Midwestern girl and had never seen a famous person in real life when they started filming this movie. And so I just had no idea what to expect. And the first movie experience was pretty special. I think the director, someone told me this, so I'm not sure, but Neil Berger was the director. He did Limitless, and then he did The Illusionist, and he did Divergent. And he was great. And
all good movies.
Yeah, I mean, I after watching him work, I have so much respect for him, and I really enjoyed his company. But anyway, he had, I think, pitched this movie to the studio as, 16 Candles in dystopian Chicago. So it was very intentionally supposed to be a coming-of-age story for a teenager. And I loved that approach, because that's what it is. She's just like your basic average teenager, except in this very strange situation. And then it kind of like the structure of the book, like it takes a real turn at a certain point and stops being that story and then starts being a totally different story. But you know, at the outset, you could see why he would present it that way. And yeah, you can see that in the movie. Like, it's not, you know, of course, like, few movies are perfect. This one is not perfect, but it is fun. And I appreciated that about it. And then he wasn't able to return for the second and third installments of the movies. And a new director came in, and he wanted to make more of a sci-fi movie. And so the series kind of, I think, got separated from what it had this heart to it that I think Neil Berger understood, even if other parts of the movie, you know, experienced, like, there were other weak parts of the movie. But I think he understood the heart of it and the emotion of it. And then that kind of got lost, I think, as the series progressed. So that was an interesting thing to watch for me. I mean, for an author, no matter what happens with the movie adaptation of your work, it's pretty much fine because the book still exists in its original form.
Yes.
And the movie will guide people to it. And so you basically win no matter what. And so it's hard to be upset. Like, I'm never going to be upset about them having made three movies. I don't care how they turned out. But, you know.
And as soon as Hollywood gets back into business, you'll have a fourth movie.
Oh, well, Chosen Ones, you
mean? Yeah,
well, fingers crossed. I mean, they bought the rights, and they seem pretty determined to make it work, and I'm very excited about it. But as with anything, it's kind of a hurry up and wait.
How long ago did Chosen One start to formulate in your head?
Ooh, I'm going to get the timeline wrong about this, but it was a few years ago. I've always loved Chosen One stories, as anyone who likes science fiction or fantasy does, probably, you know, against their will almost. For me, probably the most formative one was Dune by Frank Herbert, which my father told me to read when I was in eighth grade.
Which I haven't reread in 3 weeks, yeah.
God, I love it so much.
I actually did get to do an interview with Frank Herbert when Children of Dune came out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ooh, okay. I could talk to you about that for a long time.
Okay, Dune is, I would say Dune is at the top of the pecking order of Chosen Ones. Now, for those who haven't read the book or haven't seen it yet, what are Chosen Ones?
Well, a Chosen One figure is a type of character that is set apart, usually by destiny. Or
capital D on destiny.
Yeah, capital destiny, capital D destiny. Or they have some special skills, or both. They're like a special figure, and they're set apart for a particular burden or like mission, basically. And, you know, so like Buffy is one, Harry Potter is one, Paul Atreides is one. I would say Ender Wiggin is one. You know, there's an assortment of Narnia main characters who are Chosen Ones. So, and the Matrix, notably.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's that kind of character. And I mean, they're everywhere. And you can kind of make an argument for a lot of characters being that kind of character. But I love them, and I always have. I think because they're – I tried to think about this a lot in the last few months. Like, why? I think I always kind of wished that I was special as a kid, because I knew that I really wasn't. I was just like an average, you know, average kid in America. But I kind of longed for it. But I also loved the loneliness of those characters, how they essentially have to bear these burdens alone. And I also felt lonely as a kid, just because I was in my own little world and deeply introverted and all that. So I think I kind of identified with them and sought them out. And I was also kind of glad I wasn't that special, because, you know, the stuff that happens to these characters is not the best.
It's a rite of passage.
Yeah.
And
I mean, this, whatever they have to go through, it forces them to grow in a profound way. And I liked watching that too, I think. Watching a character kind of come into their own, like the difference between Thomas Anderson at the beginning of The Matrix and Neo at the end of that series, you know, for better or worse, is a very mm-hmm. different character. And, you know, obviously any character grows throughout the course of a story, but being forced to grow because you're so special that no one can relate to you properly is a very interesting, it's an interesting kind of story type.
In some of these books, especially with Dune, sometimes chosen ones have gotten the backlash of being, dare I say, you know, the white man's burden kind of thing.
Well, ew, yeah.
yeah, you know, here are these, you know, trying to find a non-derogatory, derogatory word, these slogs, and a person, almost always white male, comes in and shows them the way. And Dune wasn't that bad because Dune wanted to give the world over to them. But by the time you get further into the series with Dune Messiah, it's, well, you know what? You guys aren't doing a good enough job, so we're taking back the power.
Yeah.
And this has been a problem with some Chosen One stories.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, when I made a list of all the ones I was exposed to when I was young, because, you know, people are asking me about it a lot now.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, with the exception of Buffy, these are all white men, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I didn't notice as a kid because I was, you know, growing up in a predominantly white area, and it seemed normal at the time. And then you get older and you think, oh, whoa. That's a lot. I didn't really watch Buffy until I was a little bit older, but God, I loved her. I loved that she would wear makeup and high heels and, you know, cool clothes or whatever. And then just like, I had never seen a character like that up until that point. And really, I don't know. I think that's partly, it contributed to Chosen Ones because, I mean, not Buffy specifically, but just the awareness that I hadn't seen a wide array of characters when I was young, made me want to make sure that my hero was a woman, and not just a woman, but a very prickly one. She's not like pleasant to be around. So I hadn't seen that character that much. And I certainly had a craving to explore it a little bit.
Right. So give us a précis of what Chosen Ones is, now that we've discussed fictional characters of destiny.
Yes.
Well, you know, you can't just say destiny. You have to do the capital D. There should be echo and thunder.
Mm-hmm. Destiny.
Exactly.
Yeah. Chosen Ones is about a group of people who defeated a Dark Lord kind of figure known as the Dark One when they were teenagers. So they saved the world. And now it's 10 years later, they are the most famous people to ever have existed, basically, because they saved the entire planet, and they are still dealing with the psychological repercussions of what they went through when they were teenagers, and then also, of course, you know, evil doesn't stay buried, I guess.
It can't. You need sequels.
Yes. Exactly.
And you also need new takes. So where does Chosen Ones take us now that it's 10 years later?
Well, basically, there's these five people have reacted to their fame in very different ways. So Sloane is troubled by it and would really rather people just leave her alone. I think at one point she says the only thing she can really see herself wanting is to be left alone, which is almost the same as wanting nothing at all. So that is kind of her deal. And she is with one of the other Chosen Ones, her boyfriend, Matthew Weeks, who is a black man, and a Chosen One, and universally acknowledged as maybe the Chosen One, like of the five of them, it might have actually been him. And he is just trying to bear the burden of responsibility that has been kind of placed on his shoulders as a result of this incredible fame. And the others are kind of dealing with it in their own ways. Like Inez is, they say she's booby trapping her apartment like she's in a Home Alone fantasy. She's paranoid, which you I mean, seems understandable to me.
Yes.
You live your whole life in danger, and now you're paranoid. And then Albie, who's one of the other ones, has struggled with drug addiction. And then Esther, the final one, is starting a lifestyle brand. So she's clearly leaned right into it. So basically, they're coping in their own distinct ways, but none of them are okay. And that's kind of my thesis about what would really happen to if we trusted young people with this kind of burden, which, you know, P.S., we kind of do.
Yeah.
And it's it doesn't seem to me to be fair. And a lot of young adult fiction kind of sparks this thought in me, like, what are the adults doing letting this happen to people who aren't old enough to bear this burden? So this is sort of my answer to that question.
And thus your first novel targeted at adults is born.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, we've done the Divergent trilogy. What next? Not that this bears any resemblance, but.
No, but it is a little bit of a call and response. Like I wrote a Chosen One story with Divergent, and now I'm exploring what that means, I think.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, I mean, with the hard part about Chosen Ones, really, I mean, it's a straightforward narrative in some of it. And then it's also told through fake documents. So government documents and letters and articles, some poetry. There's a product review in there. There's all kinds of voices. And that required so many world building decisions for each document. And they all had to be, you know, internally consistent. So that was.
And some of the documents have redacted information.
Yes, of course.
Which I thought was fun.
It is fun. That is the most fun part. But yeah, I had to read. Oh, man, I read so many declassified government documents for this book. It was great and unsettling.
Yeah, I would think so. And that's just the declassified stuff.
Yeah, honestly, I mean, what I read primarily was MK Ultra, which is the government's experiments with LSD, unwittingly sometimes, and sometimes more wittingly.
Yeah.
But and you know, you think like, wow, how did they get away with this? And then you think, oh, we still have the systems in place where they can get away with this kind of thing. So who knows what they're doing right now? Not to be like tinfoil hat about it, but it's scary.
It is. Well, we at WBAI are, the home of left-wing conspiracy theories.
Oh, okay.
So
I'm.
Which is why I prefer to deal with speculative fiction. I do the part where we're talking about the same thing, but when I talk about it, we're talking about fiction. So.
Right.
So I have a good idea of the amazement when one can uncover some of these things. The method by which you wrote this book and some of your short stories, it's a departure from the standard narrative. Well, you're playing with the form. You're doing, you know, some parts are epistolary, some of them are, as you say, documents that further it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not just something that pops up, it's something that is part of the storytelling.
Right. And, I mean, the main character, Sloane, submits a Freedom of Information Act request in order to get access to these documents, at least in the first section. So they do have an effect on the narrative. So you're reading them and discovering things, but also Sloane is reading them and discovering them.
Mm-hmm. So we're working at two levels at that point.
Mm-hmm.
We're not only taking in the information, but we're also taking in what this is going to do for her.
Right.
This would have been far more ideal, were you here and, were tomorrow where we were going to have you on stage reading on Facebook Live with an audience on Facebook Live. But do you feel up to reading a section?
I do. Do you have any in particular, or should I just choose one?
No, author's choice. It's always right. My rule.
Well, I'm going to read from one of the articles. This is the longer article that begins the book. I mean, there's two little things before it, but this is our introduction to Sloane. And, you know, anyway, you'll see. It's a celebrity profile, basically. Okay. It's called Sloane Andrews Doesn't Care. No, really. By Rick Lane in Trilby Magazine, January 24th, 2020. I don't like Sloane Andrews, but I might want to sleep with her. I meet her at her usual, at her neighborhood coffee shop, one of her usual haunts, or so she says. The barista doesn't seem to recognize her as either a customer or one of the five teenagers who took down the Dark One almost a decade ago. Which, to be honest, seems remarkable, because world-famous face aside, Sloane Andrews is that wholesome, clean brand of gorgeous that makes you want to get it dirty. If she's wearing makeup, I can't see it. She's all clear skin and big blue eyes, a walking, talking cosmetics ad. She's wearing a Cubs hat when she comes in with her long brown hair pulled through the back, a gray t-shirt that's tight in all the right places, ripped jeans that show off long, shapely legs, and a pair of sneakers. They're the kind of clothes that say she doesn't give a fuck about coils them. And that's the thing about Sloane. I believe it. I believe all meeting me. She didn't even want to do the interview. She only agreed, she said, because her boyfriend, Matthew Weeks, fellow chosen one, asked her to support the release of his new book, Still Choosing. February 3rd. Sorry, got it. Oh, my God. All right. In our preliminary exchanges about this interview, she didn't have many ideas for where I might meet her. Even though everyone in Chicago already knows where Sloane lives, in the north side neighborhood of Uptown, just blocks from Lakeshore Drive, she flat-out refused to let me see her apartment. I don't go anywhere, she wrote. I get accosted when I do. So unless you want to try to keep up with me on a run, it's Java Jam or nowhere. I'm not sure I could take notes and jog at the same time, so Java Jam it is. Her coffee secured, she takes off the baseball cap and her hair falls to her shoulders like she was just tumbling around on a mattress. But something about her face, maybe it's her slightly too close together eyes or the way she cocks her head sharply when she doesn't like what you just said, makes her look like a bird of prey. With a single glance, she's turned the tables and I'm the one on guard, not her. I fumble for my first question, and where most people might smile and try to get me to like them, Sloane just stares. The 10-year anniversary of your victory over the Dark One is coming up, I say. How does it feel? It feels like survival, she says. Her voice is flinty and sharp. It makes a shiver go down my spine, and I can't figure out if that's a good thing or not. Not triumph, I ask, and she rolls her eyes. Next question, she replies, and she takes her first sip of coffee. That's when I realize it. I don't like her. This woman saved thousands, no, millions of lives. Hell, she probably saved my life in one way or another. At 13, she was named by prophecy along with four others as someone who would defeat an all-powerful being of pure malice. She survived a handful of battles with the Dark One, including a brief kidnapping, the details of which she has never shared, and came out of it unscathed and beautiful, more famous than anyone in the history of being famous. And to top it off, she's in a long-term relationship with Matthew Weeks, Golden Boy, the chosen one among chosen ones, and quite possibly the kindest person alive. But I still don't like her. And she couldn't care less. Which is why I want to sleep with her. It's as if, by getting her naked and in my bed, I could force her into some kind of warmth or emotion. She turns me into an alpha male, a hunter, hell-bent on taking down the most elusive prey on the planet and putting its head on my living room wall as a trophy. Maybe that's why she gets accosted when she goes anywhere. Not because people love her, but because they want to love her, want to make her lovable. When she sets down her mug, I see the scar on the back of her right hand. It's wide, stretching all the way across, and jagged and knotted. She's never told anyone where it's from, and I'm sure she won't tell me, but I have to ask anyway. Paper cut, she says. I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be a joke, so I laugh. I ask her if she's going to the dedication of the 10 years monument, an installation artwork erected on the site of the Dark One's defeat. And she tells me it's part of the gig. Like this is a desk job she applied for instead of a literal destiny. It sounds like you don't enjoy it, I say. What gave me away? She smirks. In the lead up to the interview, I asked a few friends what they thought of her to get a sense of how the average Joe perceives Sloane Andrews. One of them remarked that he had never actually seen her smile, and as I sit across from her, I find myself wondering if she ever does. I even wonder it out loud. I'm curious to know how she'll respond. Not well, as it turns out. If I were a dude, she says, would you ask me that question? I steer us away from that topic as quickly as possible. This is less a conversation and more a game of Minesweeper, with me getting more and more tense with every box I click, every one increasing the odds I'll set off one of those mines. I click once more, inquiring about whether this time of year brings back memories for her. I try not to think about it, she says. If I did, my life would turn into a goddamn advent calendar. For every day, there's another Dark One chocolate in a different shape. I click again, asking if there are any good memories to choose from. We were all friends, you know. We always will be. We speak almost entirely in inside jokes more together. Phew. I guess it's safe to ask her about the other four chosen ones. Esther Park, Albert Summers, Inez Mejia, and of course, Matthew Weeks. It's there that we finally get into a groove. The so-called chosen ones bonded quickly after they met with Matt as their natural leader. That's just the way he is, she says, and it almost sounds like she's annoyed by it. Always taking charge, taking responsibility, reminding us to argue about ethics, that sort of thing. Surprisingly, it wasn't Matt with whom she had an immediate connection, but Albie. He was quiet, she says, and it's a compliment. All of our brothers and fathers had died. That was part of the prophecy. But my brother had died the most recently. I needed the quiet. Plus, the Midwest, Alberta, they're similar places. Albert and Inez lived together, platonically, since Inez identifies as a lesbian, in Chicago, and Esther went home to Glendale, California, to take care of her ailing mother just last year. The distance has been hard for all of them, Sloane says, but luckily they can all keep up with Esther on her active and popular Insta page, where she documents the minutia of her life. What do you think about the All Chosen movement that's popped up in the last few years, I ask. The All Chosen Movement is a small but vocal group that advocates for emphasizing the role the other four chosen ones played in the defeat of the Dark One, rather than attributing the victory primarily to Matthew Weeks. Sloane doesn't mince words. I think it's racist. Some of them say that elevating Matt over the rest of you is sexist, I point out. What's sexist is ignoring what I say and claiming I don't know any better, she replies. I think Matt's the real chosen one. I said so multiple times. Don't pretend you're doing me a favor by knocking him down. I then move the conversation from the chosen ones to the Dark One, and that's when everything goes awry. I ask Sloane why the Dark One seemed to take a special interest in her. She keeps her eyes on mine as she sips the last of her coffee, and when she sets the cup down, her hand is shaking. Then she puts her Cubs hat right over that glorious, just-fucked hair and says, "We're done here." And I guess if she says we're done, because Sloane is out of there. I throw a 10 down on the table and run after her, not willing to give up that easily. Did I mention Sloane Andrews turns me into a hunter? I had one off-limits topic, she snaps at me. Do you remember what it was? She's flushed and furious and radiant, part dominatrix and part sly, spitting street cat. Why did I wait this long to really piss her off? I could have been staring at this the entire time. The off-limits topic was, of course, anything specific about her relationship to the Dark One. Surely she didn't expect me to abide by that, I remark. It's the most interesting thing about her. She looks at me like I'm the soggy piece of paper in an alley puddle, traffic to get away from me. This time, I let her go.
That is a lovely pastiche.
It certainly establishes some things.
Yes, it really does. And what a wonderful way to bring the exposition.
Right.
Of what came before is by triangulating from all these different places.
Yeah.
What kind of research, if any, outside of delving within yourself did you do for this book?
There was a lot. So even just for that article alone that I just read, I read an array of celebrity profiles. So Margot Robbie, Scarlett Johansson, Britney Spears, all of them have been covered in a kind of misogynistic way by reporters. So that one required a day of research. Other than that, I mean, there were like kind of hundreds of government documents from MKUltra and Project Blue Book, which is the UFO stuff from the government. But I also had to develop an alternate history for this book. So there's basically an alternate universe in which the space race didn't happen and something else happened instead to cause the proliferation of magic through the universe. So I had to do a lot of research on history and that kind of, and that it's a bit of a spoiler, I guess, but anyway, it just kind of rippled outward from there, because if you don't have the space race and if you have this catastrophic event, then it affects computers, products, fashion, technology, design, everything. So, I mean, that was like the thing I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to do when I set out to write the book, which is of course why I decided to set out and write it. But yeah, a lot more research for this book than for any other book I've ever written.
It seems that way because its roots are so established in, as you read the book, it becomes its own reality. You really get drawn into it, which is what good speculative fiction is supposed to do.
Right. Well, thank you.
And I really
glad you received it that way.
Yes, no, absolutely, absolutely. Given that you have written one question first. Without giving any reveals about the end of the book, do you see this universe being taken further in your writing?
I do. So I finished it, and I very much wanted it to be complete. I have done the cliffhanger thing before, and I don't want to do it again. So it feels like a unit, and I also proposed a second book with a detailed outline. So, yeah.
Okay, cool.
That'll be it, I think.
Okay, so another duology.
Yes, I really like a duology. Yeah.
Yeah, so do I. Having said that, I have to admit that I have not read the Carve the Mark books.
But, well, that's all.
But they're in my ebook list. So I'm going to be doing those. And by the way, after that reading, I hope you get to do the audiobook.
Well, I didn't, but I did read one of the documents in the audiobook. So it was a full cast audiobook, which is awesome because I love when a book feels like a stage play in audio form. My favorite.
Who did it?
Well, Audible did it. Okay. But the voice was Dakota Fanning, the actress. So yes, that was cool. But then there was, you know, a cast around her, and I read one of the articles, so that was really fun.
Very cool. Very nice. So at this point, you have a duology, you have this blockbuster trilogy, you've written enough short stories to have a collection out. What... And you've written science fiction, you've written fantasy, because anything with magic, no matter how realistic that magic may be, is by definition fantasy. So long form, short form, spec fic, in either case, what is your favorite form of writing?
Oh, I like a novel. Yeah.
Yeah.
I find short fiction to be very hard. I dread it a lot more than I dread writing a novel, which is odd considering how much less time it takes. But I really like to dig into a character or live with a character in a world for a while. for a year at least, which is, you know, generally how long it takes me to write them, although I'm getting slower every time, which is fine. I think that's my favorite form.
Okay. And yet you continue writing really good short stories.
Well, thanks. I think the challenge is important. So you learn a lot from writing short stories that you don't from writing novels. You have to learn how to really pare down what it is that you want to say or what you want to explore in a really narrow way. And especially recently, a couple of the ones I've written have been much shorter than even the other short stories I've written, such as the one in Lightspeed right now.
Which is the least of these.
Yes, the least of these. It's the shortest story I've ever written. And a weird futuristic fable. So that was interesting. But I think you really have to have a clarity that you can kind of, you have to have clarity when you write a novel, but you can get there slowly. You know, you can write a weird first draft and it's not clear, and then you can kind of tease out the parts of it that are working and find the book that is inside of the other book. But with a short story, you really have to figure that out sooner, and you have to accomplish things very quickly. Get the character in, make them interesting, and really, like, get going. So, and in sci-fi especially, short stories are, I don't know, I feel like short stories are really alive in science fiction.
Yeah.
The way that, you know, I guess they are in other genres, but this is the one that I like, so.
There was a time when short stories were not doing very well outside of, say, The New Yorker, but they were still very, very much alive in spec fic.
Yeah, and I read them in speculative fiction, even though I don't always read them in any other genre. So they're a place for a thought experiment. You know, you don't have to, like, write a whole book about it. Like in the Ted Chiang collection, the Exhalation collection, where that story, Anxiety is the Dizziness of Freedom, it's about, it's about communicating with your parallel self and the kind of support groups that would arise if you were to do something like that. And I love that story, but, like, can you do that for an entire novel? Probably not. Like, it's supposed to be a short story. That's its ideal form. And so I love thinking about that, and I loved being in that story, and I still think about it, but it's definitely, like, suited for the short story form.
Yeah, and he's a master of that. He really is.
He is, and he finds the human feelings really well. You know, I think in science fiction, that's a common goal, you know, find the humanity and inside the interesting concept. But his focus is very much like on our frailty and our vulnerability, and I really appreciate that about his work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to say the same. He's one of the best of the short form, no question about it. But as I say, I really discovered you as a fine writer from your shorter work.
Well, thanks.
You know, I you know, just talking about the craft of writing.
Yeah.
And the way we are introduced to the ideas. And that's one of the things that, for me, short stories do, is they are polished gems, but they are also so much more work to write.
Yeah. Every sentence feels like, it feels like writing a sentence with, like, a little pair of tweezers, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the way you put that.
It's hard. I'm not always up for it, but increasingly, I think I do enjoy it, as especially like an exercise to force myself to improve.
Mm-hmm. What other media have you not broken into or been adapted with that you would like to see happen?
Ooh, well, I don't know.
What, theater?
I don't know if I really feel one way or another about theater. One day it would be so cool to get into TV somehow.
Oh yeah.
I'm just an avid television watcher, so I would love to see that. That would be cool. But then the dramatized podcast would also be very cool.
Mm-hmm.
So one day.
Yeah, well, that's something to talk to John Joseph Adams about.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Because I'm that's the end of that Skyboat Media with whom I work. I can imagine theater, even though I'm a radio person. My first thought is always radio. So I was so pleased when you said that. But I like theater, too. And I think that I think I can see, not just hear, but see some of your work happening that way.
I hadn't really thought about it, I guess.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm just, you know, fanishly throwing around ideas.
I like it.
Cool. Where are you going from here in literature and or essays?
Well, really, I have the follow-up to Chosen Ones to write, and that will be my next novel. And other than that, I continue to look into short story possibilities and and a little bit of essay I have been exploring a little bit. So we'll see where that goes, but it nowhere concrete yet. But, yeah.
I know you have a collection of essays, but where do your essays...
I don't.
No. Oh, you don't? I beg your pardon. Well, that's something that needs to be corrected. But where do most of your essays appear?
Well, I haven't really had any published, but I have just been expanding. I have a newsletter that I sort of have revamped to make it a little more like a monthly essay situation, usually about writing, but sometimes not.
Well, I don't know what to say other than I really would like to do this again.
Yeah, that would be great. It's been really nice talking to you.
Good. Thank you. Likewise. That was an interview with Veronica Roth conducted in April 2020 when the original hardcover of Chosen Ones came out. The softcover was recently released. You have been listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. Next week, our guest will be pundit and critic Emmett Asher Perrin. Don't forget to support WBAI by making a pledge at 212-209-2950 or visiting give2wbai.org. That's the number 2, give2wbai.org. I'll be back next Saturday morning at 7 a.m. Stay tuned for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Good morning.
Tune to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up is Any Saturday with David Rothenberg at 8 o'clock. Please stay tuned.
33 cents a day. Not much, is it? Loose change. A third of a cup of coffee. It's nothing. But did you know that 33 cents a day can help WBAI stay on the air? That's all it takes. As little as 33 cents a day, $10 a month, you can be a BAI buddy. A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a recurring monthly donation to WBAI using either a credit card, debit card, or by electronic fund transfer from your bank account. It's safe, secure, and easy, and it helps keep our unique, alternative, and diverse programming on the air. You'll get a WBAI membership card and other goodies. Sign up online. Go to WBAI.org and click on donate. All the details are right there. The WBAI buddy. Be one today.
The next Community Advisory Board meeting will be held on Sunday, August 15th, 2021 at 1 p.m. The meeting will be held on Zoom and by phone. For contact information, go to the CAB page, that's Community Advisory Board page at WBAI.org, or to KPFTX.org. The board reviews the programming schedule, budgets, and assists with long-term plans for the station. The CAB is made up of listeners to WBAI who donate their time. Meetings are open to the public. And once again, the next Community Advisory Board meeting will be held Sunday, August 15th, 2021 at 1 p.m. on Zoom. To connect, find information on the CAB page on WBAI.org or KPFTX.org. Everyone is welcome to attend the meetings. Hope you can attend.
Hi, this is Hannah from WBAI's Premiums Department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time. Again, please call 212-209-2870 if you have a question about a premium you ordered, or email premiums@wbai.org.
Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. My name is Bill Samuels, founder of NYPeoplesConvention.org. WBAI is New York's leader in progressive talk. Whether the issue is prison reform, education reform, the legalization of marijuana, or women's rights, the people's issues are covered on these airways. So stay tuned for the best and leading-edge progressive ideas and analysis. And remember to support independent media financially.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music. It does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go. You have to push it. I got a million of them, a million of them. Now you know that, so you can't go wrong. Yeah, 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 yeah. You start off each day with a song. You've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, soft. A little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song. Oh boy, you're singing now. Even when things go wrong. Oh Jimmy, you're a wow. You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that, so you can't go wrong. Yeah, 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 yeah. You start off each day with a song.
Well, thank you, Jimmy Durante. And good morning to all the Helens of the world listening this morning. I'm David Rothenberg. It's the 7th of August. Is that it? Yeah. It's the 7th of August. I have a lot on my mind today. There was a story, an op-ed piece in the New York Times yesterday. Don't shame young people into getting vaccines. An interesting story about how did we, the elderly, have to deal delicately with the children, the 18 to 24-year-olds. Of the world. And it explains why, or the authors, Rainier Stauffer and Abdullah Shishipar, try to explain why young people are resistant, but they omit one thing, the internet. The internet. You hear that? They're getting misinformation. They're not watching or they're not reading the New York Times, the Washington Post, getting news that has been double checked, triple checked. They are getting the information from the internet. And what I have discovered in the emails that I get but on vaccinations and on Donald Trump, people who are still think Donald Trump won the election, is that their sources are constantly from isolated people who have been perceived as experts on the internet. And I, the vaccination ones I get from BAI listeners over and over again. There may be 2,000 doctors today talking about getting vaccinations, but let one be on the internet and he or she is suddenly described as an expert, somebody that we have to pay heed to. The same is true with Trump. Let me give you an example of what the internet is like. I mean, I knew it was bad. And you may have known it was bad, but how bad? 280, thank you, Pam, from Brooklyn, for sending this to me, from a friend in South Dakota who was a devoted Trumpie. 280,000 people have gotten this story on the internet, and it looks like a real legitimate news story. It's got a headline, U.S. military holding White House for Trump's return, by Michael Baxter, end of July. There's a picture of a very stern looking, presidential looking Donald Trump. Now I'm going to read you the story. This has gone to 283,000 people. That's how many have opted to get it. How many have passed it on and had others read it. Bear with me. You may find this fascinating. The man who calls himself president, Joseph R. Biden, has never set foot in the real White House. That's the first sentence of the article. Real Raw News can now report, immediately following the result of the 2020 presidential election, the U.S. military assumed provisional control of the White House amid concerns that Biden and his deep state allies had indeed stolen the election. That's the first paragraph. Shall we continue? On election night, as president, Donald J. Trump's commanding lead over Biden, he lost by 7 million votes. Trump's commanding lead over Biden seemed to magically evaporate. The U.S. military was already investigating reports of collusion between the Biden campaign and the Chinese-sponsored hacking group Nakayan, which is surreptitiously funded by the PLA. The shadowy cyber warfare group has a history of interfering in foreign elections and is a principal player in the PLA's cyber war with Taiwan. The military has evidence proving that the Biden campaign not only has knowledge of, but also encouraged Nikon's intrusion into Dominion voting machines. Dominion provided election equipment and software in 28 states, including battleground states where Trump's imperious advantage shifted in favor of Biden during the wee hours of the morning. While America slept, the military watched. I'm reading an article from the internet. This is what people are reading in America. On November 4th, at 5 a.m., Trump received a telephone call from Chief of Staff's member, Marine Corps General David H. Berger, who revealed that Chinese saboteurs had penetrated Dominion voting machines in at least six states. General Berger told Trump the military has failed to thwart the attack because someone on the inside fought its efforts to regain control of voting software. When Trump asked Berger to consult Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark A. Milley, Berger reported, "Mr. President, I don't think we can trust him. I suggest you immediately sign the Insurrection Act." You may recall that Mark Milley has claimed that Trump's bananas. Chief of Staff. The Insurrection Act of 1807, when enacted, supersedes the Posse Comitatus Act, the latter of which limits the powers of the federal government and the use of federal military prisoners to enforce domestic policies within the United States. 3 days after the election, as fraudulent votes were being tallied, General Berger told Trump he'd do everything possible to prevent Biden's installation as president. But on day four, almost every media outlet, most of Congress, and the liberal elite endorsed Biden as the victor. Despite his illegitimate victory, Biden met an unwelcome surprise when he arrived at the White House on January 20th. Now, here's where it really goes into Looney Tunes. You think all of that was nutso. Instead of getting a ceremonial greeting, he and Kamala Harris were stopped by National Guard and U.S. Marines at the barbed wire fence encircling the White House. The Marines informed them that the military had assumed control of the executive branch and instructed them to vacate the area. When Harris belligerently said, "Move aside, we're president now," the Marines locked the gate. That's what's known as the strong black woman. Although most military supported Trump, Biden had his allies, the intelligence agencies, the Secret Service, and dissident elements of the U.S. military, including a few high-ranking generals and admirals. RRN heard but cannot confirm, that's Raw News, heard but cannot confirm a report of a brief firefight that occurred after Kamala Harris had ordered the Secret Service to storm the White House. According to the report, two Secret Service agents were killed, one Marine seriously injured before Biden's forces were repelled from the grounds. To avoid shame and maintain an illusion of power, Biden's people Now, you think that we're at Looney Tunes? Now we're going now we're up in the air somewhere, to avoid shame and an illusion of power, Biden's people concocted a ruse supported by his media allies to deceive the American people into believing he had won a fair election and move that White House on schedule. Inside, now, I'm going to try and read this with a straight face. This is what is going out to people. Inside actor-producer Tyler Berry's 300-acre Atlanta estate sits a three-story stucco replica of the commander-in-chief's residence, which he originally built as a set piece for a television show. Perry, a Democrat, who endorsed Biden and funneled millions into his campaign, allowed Biden to use the fake White House as an operating base.